A little idle chatter about the people that we know. And though it doesn't matter, is there a different way of saying hello?
You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit www.questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
This is Meg Riley in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and you've joined us for another episode of The View. Let's start by having our regulars say hello.
Hi, I'm Joanna Fontaine Crawford, and I am here in Austin, Texas.
I'm Hank Peirce, and I'm speaking to you from lovely Medford, Massachusetts.
And I'm Tom Shade, and I'm in Ann Arbor, Michigan. How are you all?
You can hear us. Yay!
I'm in Apple Valley.
My headphones just totally blew up my system here, and they weren't otherwise. But
I know. Tom, we apologize for live, folks. We were a few minutes late because poor Tom was bouncing on and off trying to get here. And we'll be talking with our special guest, Emily Rosenzweig. Did I say that right? Rosenzweig?
Yep.
Okay, great. We'll be talking
first
to her.
First time, too.
Excellent. We'll be talking to her about Happy the App. I'll ask our guest to introduce herself, and then I'll say a little bit about why I was excited to invite her on this morning. So, Emily.
Hi, my name's Emily Rosenzweig. I am a co-founder of a new app called Happy, and I'm also a professor of marketing at Tulane University in New Orleans. Though right now, actually, I'm not that far from you, Bob, because I'm in Ithaca, New York, just outside. So, but yes, nice to meet you.
So I probably know the street you're on.
So I got an email from one of the colleagues of Emily's working on this app and had a conversation with him. His mother is UU, and that's how he happened to call me. And I was really interested in the premise of this app and what it has to say about what church means and what community means and what pastoral care means in this time. So, Emily, I will let you describe the app rather than me doing a secondhand version of that. And then we will talk about some of the research that led you to think it's important. That's also research that we're a little obsessed with in the church world. And so tell us, how did you come to create this app? And what is the app?
So basically the app is, and it's under development now. We're in sort of very initial stages, but we're hoping to have something that people can download in probably August. Is an app that's going to provide access to emotional support on demand from a real live human being, basically whenever people need it. So access to affirmation, encouragement, comfort, validation, motivation, basically at the push of a button with a real life person who's been vetted and has demonstrated that they're good at doing it. They're a compassionate listener who has skills at providing that kind of those emotional resources. So that's sort of the basic idea.
And that was actually part of Jeremy's interest, is he thought people like his mother, a retired UU, would be great at this. Yeah. And he thought from knowing her that UUs would have a natural ability to do this kind of support for people who called. And I was thinking, you know, there are a lot of homebound CLF members, for instance, mm-hmm. who could use a little bit of income. So as I understand it, it's like a pay-for-service mm-hmm. kind of thing, right? So I'm really curious what kind of research makes you think... So what kind of research made you think this was an important app to develop, first of
all? So, I mean, there's a ton of research suggesting that, well, first of all, where there's like epidemic levels of loneliness and social isolation, as well as of stress. And both of those have been linked to like a whole litany of health conditions. The medical community sees social isolation as being just about as deadly as diabetes. So I think there's, you know, there's that side of thing that there's, I think, clearly a real need in that sense. And then there's a lot of research suggesting that genuine human connection is like sort of the most powerful source of human happiness, right? We're an ultra-social species. There's really no substitute for another human being's attention and care and listening and compassion. So I think, you know, those things together suggested, hey, there's a real need. And that I think there's reason to believe that it doesn't have to come from someone that you know well. And, you know, we've all had the experience of talking to a bartender, talking to someone next to us on the airplane, talking to people that we don't know that actually sometimes can be even more helpful because we feel a little bit freer sharing some things with a stranger than we might with people that we engage with every day.
Hmm. And so, I mean, obviously people have done this for sex for quite a while with you know, paying money and calling, but I'm really curious whether there's research to show that people would do this for loneliness. I mean, I'm trying to think how it would be to make that call and to say, yeah, I'm going to pay, what, $7 to get some support now or something like that? Is it by the minute or how does it work?
It'll be prorated. So, yeah, it'll be, you know, by the minute for as long as you want. So it could be, you know, you're coming home from work, you've had a difficult day, you don't want to go home and dump all of that on your spouse right away. You talk to someone for 10 or 15 minutes just to sort of get it off your chest, get heard, and then go home and are in a better position to care for your kids and engage with your family. Or it could be, you know, I want to spend an hour on the weekend really talking through something. I don't feel like I have enough support, or my friends and family have already heard me talk about these issues so much, I don't feel comfortable, you know, going back to them again. But I think, you know, to your point of whether or not this is something that people will pay for, I think it's a really important question. And I think we see that it's going to be, you know, meaningful work to change the conversation around what it means to seek support. You know, right now, people go out for a drink after work, no problem. There's no stigma associated with that. There's no stigma associated with getting yourself a massage or going for a pedicure or doing some retail therapy, right? But we want to sort of treat talking to a compassionate listener like a treat that you give to yourself, something that boosts you up, that helps you going when you're sort of struggling a little bit, but that is sort of normal part of sort of self-care and something that you would do to support yourself.
So the people who will be answering the calls, is it mostly just listening or are they going to give advice?
So it's mostly listening unless someone is specifically listening and validation, right, and support, unless someone asks specifically for advice. And so we will, you know, we'll be providing some training. We think that there are people that really have a natural aptitude at this and we're sort of seeking those people out. But what I would say is that we don't want this to be an advice service unless that's what people want. Right, because I think that often happens when we share issues is that rather than listen and support, we get, well, why don't you do this and why don't you do that? And so we definitely want to avoid that. Ooh. Now I can't hear you guys.
Well, because we're not saying anything.
Okay.
That was silence.
Panic!
Yeah, we're the only TV video show that believes in the power of silence, which other people call dead air, but occasionally we lapse into that. So don't worry about it. But it's, you know, feel validated by it, okay?
I think we were all absorbing that. Tom, were you about to say something?
Well, you know what I was thinking about? I mean, this is just random, but... you know, there's a lot of people who call psychic lines, you know, which I think are exactly the same thing, except, you know, dressed with a little thing, a little, you know, woo-woo stuff. But, you know, basically, you know, a psychic line is someone who has the skills to listen to what you're saying and validate what you're saying, basically. You know, they have that touch, that gift, you know.
And I think part of what we're finding makes a big difference, we've been doing pilot calls, so we've been basically providing a service for free as sort of a proof of concept of, does this actually help people? We do a pre and a post survey, how are you feeling before and after? And showing really exciting results. So, I mean, you know, like 90% of the people that have called feel better after the call than they did before. We see an average of like a 30% increase on sort of the scale that we use of how happy they felt before to after. And a really, I think, 85 or 86% of people saying they want to use this again regularly, they would want to do this. But sort of to your point, I think one of the things that has made these calls so powerful is the listening and also the sort of valid, you know, people are calling in, they're struggling with divorce, they're struggling with people, family members that are ill, a whole range of issues. And one thing we try to do is sort of help them see strengths in themselves that are allowing them to persevere and get through this. you know, in that way, I sort of think of my husband's a social worker, and I think of it a little bit sort of as having the social work model of building on people's strengths. Mm-hmm. But I think when you're in these situations, you know, we do so little validating of each other on our day-to-day lives, right? If you think about most people's work life, how often do people really get validated for what they're bringing to the table? And, you know, I think the same, unfortunately, in people's home lives. So I think just the idea that there's someone who can recognize strengths in you and remind you of them is just a really powerful thing.
I was thinking of that Beacon book about the lonely American from a few years ago, written by two psychologists who said that they had surveyed people, and in like 1980, the average person said they had two people that they could talk to about what mattered most to them. And when they redid it in, I can't remember, like 2000, 25% of the people said there was no one. And that wasn't even like who you could share like secrets with. It was just who you could talk to about what's important to you. I think those are statistics that we as ministers take really seriously. And of course, we hope that our congregations are happy, the church, you know, but they're not always.
I had a conversation just yesterday morning with someone. It was walk to school day here in Medford, and we always walk to school anyway. But I was talking to another parent who's part of a Medford Walks program, and he was saying how he had just finished reading one study about folks. One of the reasons why folks who were planning to commit suicide didn't. And one of the things was that someone waved and said hi to them that morning, whom they didn't even really know. But just, I mean, something as simple as that, like someone's, you know, recognized me, and that was enough for me to say, hey, I'm not invisible. I'm doing something here.
Yeah, there's actually good research on that. A friend of mine, Jillian Sandstrom, has work on the power of weak social ties. So exactly that. The people you just see in passing, the supermarket checkout person that you see every time, and that has a really sort of powerful ability to make people happier on a sort of a daily level. So yeah, I saw
a study of libraries that if a librarian just touches someone as they check out, they tend to say they like that library like exponentially more. So, and of course, everybody's being warned not to touch anyone, right? I mean, even young kids, no one's supposed to touch them anymore. So, yeah, it's really
interesting to me. In that, you know, I've had this experience of moving into a new community the last couple of years, and then moving again into a new community, and now I'm moving into another new community. And the difference it made when I was finally recognized in a store, when I lived someplace, and in a restaurant, made a huge difference in how I felt about where I was living. I go back to those places all the time now because somebody recognized me. You know, that
we all want to go where somebody knows our, where everybody knows our name.
Right, I know. One of the things about, I did my CPE in a hospital, of course, and a lot of the work was validating, where people were at and what they were feeling, et cetera. But I always felt that one of the reasons why the validation worked is that people didn't assume I was going to give it to them. That in fact there was a kind of there was a little bit of a contradiction in the sense that I walk in as the chaplain and they actually expect me to be judgmental, right? Because of everything that they project onto ministry, they expect me to be judgmental. And then when I'm not, when I validate where they're at, that's such a, it really counts. It really counts. In a way that if I walked in with the big, I'm a resident validator, and what you say, I will validate.
I take your point, but I guess, and I can see that the, what in psychology we call the expectancy violation, might essentially amplify that effect, but I think if we think about like our own set of friends, right, I know that if I'm having a hard day, I know which friends I call, and they're not the people that it's going to be a surprise if they make me feel better. Right, so I, and in fact, I think probably a lot of us who actually have extended social networks you know, even know, it's like, okay, there's the friend that I call when I need encouragement to persevere with my research, and then there's the friend that I call when I'm just, like, I'm really down about a relationship, right, and that we know, and we turn to people specifically for the types of resources that they can provide us. So I don't doubt that there is an extra punch of, like, wow, I thought I was going to get judged, and I didn't, but I don't think you need that in order to benefit.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, arguing that, you know. That you should have a judgment app, you know, or call up.
I'd like judgment, please.
I want to make wait, that's the Calvinist app. I like it. I like it.
Yeah, Calvin app. Well, I'm really actually going
to
have a
damnation. Why not a damnation app? You're going to hell. You're going to hell.
Press two for tough criticism from a friend.
I can completely understand the need to have a safe place where you can talk about something that's going on in your life, where you don't have to be protective of the other person. And I'm thinking my experience was I have a daughter who was very sick, and I did it through blogging anonymously, but I needed a place where I didn't have to say, oh, it's okay, where I could just really let the awful come out. But I do want to ask about this. On the other side, often we don't want to go into conflict when we should, you know, with our child or our husband or whatever. Is there any kind of coaching that the person on the other end of the phone would be doing in terms of, you know, if someone just calls and is, oh, my boss did this, the other person saying something like, well, have you talked to your boss about this? You know, are you set up for anything like that?
So what I would say is that we don't plan on setting lots of we don't want it to be sort of a mechanical service, right? So we don't plan on strictly conscribing the providers to a script. Right, that's sort of antithetical to what we're going for. And so I have no doubt that there will be people who do a little of that coaching when the person seems receptive to it. And it's sort of along the lines of advice giving, where it's like, okay, does it seem like they'd be receptive? Is there another perspective they could take, right, that might be helpful? And actually, the perspective taking is interesting because in our pilot, we ask people sort of what button they would push, right? What would they be looking for? And, you know, we have things like compassion, empathy, et cetera. And about 50% of the people, and they could push multiple, but about 50% of the people push perspective, that they are looking for just someone to help, right? You get so stuck in your own way of seeing a situation, and maybe your friends and family have been stuck there with you, and you just want someone to give you some perspective. And I actually took a call like this where it was someone who was going through a career change, trying to figure out what her next move should be. Should she settle for a job that she doesn't love? Should she keep going? And she just really wanted an outsider's perspective, and she told me that. And so I was able to do that for her.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you find people to be the listeners?
Actually, so that part has been easier than even we had hoped it would be, at least initially. So we started out with just a message to one of our co-founders is part of, I guess what you'd call sort of like a creative persons Facebook group, people that are sort of involved in creative enterprises broadly, mostly women. And she posted a message to this Facebook group basically saying, we're looking for compassionate listeners who would potentially want to earn income in this meaningful way, and it's very flexible, et cetera. And basically, it's just been a snowball effect of those people interviewed, they told their friends about it. We had originally hoped to recruit 100 that would be sort of our initial base for when we launch in August or September formally, and we're well over 100 now with people continuing to come in. So that part has been very encouraging. I think because also if you think about like the sort of the gig economy, right, and what that offers to people, like, you know, this is just a much more meaningful and substantive type of part than is available in many cases, right? And so I think the prospect of doing something where I could work part-time on my own schedule, like literally log in when I have an extra couple of hours, the prospect of doing that and having the work actually feel like I'm helping someone, I think is pretty powerful to people.
How do you know that the person who volunteered is going to be good at this and not meeting their own needs first?
Yeah, so initially, so our first step is that we do a phone interview with people, and we do a little bit of role-playing and get a gauge for them sort of right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately, when the system is live, what will happen is, in addition to that phone interview, our callers will rate their providers, and anyone that basically doesn't maintain a certain rating won't be allowed to continue. So essentially, our callers will vet people for us in the long term, in addition to this initial screening.
And you aren't really interested in training people to do this. You're looking for the people who already do this well and then move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in part because I don't think we want it to feel super scripted, right? We want to access people's natural resources.
Mm-hmm. It is very interesting to, you know, I think it's very interesting to clergy, because clergy are in this position where we're trying to roll out and expand our ability to be, pastoral care, pastoral care, or at least pastoral, friendship inside our churches. And we're trying to recruit lay people to do that, which we often, often ends up on the minister's desk or on the minister's phone line, to do that. And we get, a lot of it goes into training, supervising, et cetera, lay ministers, we're calling them. And but you're saying, don't bother with that. Just look for people who naturally do it well.
So the best way to describe this. I think there is value in training and in supervising and in shepherding, 100%. I don't think that as a service we're likely to be able to provide that. So it's not that in theory I don't see the value in that, but there's a whole bunch of reasons not probably worth getting into why I don't think we're likely to be able to provide that, and that's part of why we're looking for people who don't need a lot of it. But that's not to say that even people who are naturally good can't benefit from all the expertise that you guys have, right? Which is, basically all of you started out naturally good at this and then got a ton of training, right? So it's...
Oh, I'm not so sure about that. No. That was the thing I
wasn't so sure on either of those problems.
But I will say...
Your goodwill.
Tom talked about his about the clinical pastoral education experience that all of us who are on the ministry path have done, where we, and are you familiar with it, Emily?
Not specifically to UU, so I'm broadly familiar, but not with the UU path.
It's standard across denominations. It's an external organization that authorizes it, but you go and do one unit is 3 months full time, where you're in a hospital, or some other kind of setting, spending maybe 60% of your time doing pastoral care and 30% or 40% in reflection. But the thing is, everybody starts as a beginner. Most people start as a very beginner, and they throw you right in. I don't know about other programs, but my program was that first week we were walking the floors in the wards and walking into patients' bedrooms or rooms and pretending to be ministers, and it was a learning by doing kind of thing. But most of the time, it's terrifying to be the person walking in the room, but it's actually okay. Mm-hmm. Showing up is enough.
And the first call I took, I think I played this. I sort of played this role with a lot of my friends, so it wasn't that I didn't have any experience with this. But I remember the first call I took with a stranger. I for sure was what do I do? What do I say? And then, very quickly it felt normal. So I think it's true that there is, for people who have some aptitude for this, I think there's a little bit of once you get into it, if you have these reserves of compassion, they come out, right? Mm-hmm. And they're triggered by talking to people who are really in need and are not being supported. That's the other thing is, the people I've talked to, it's not hard to be affirming and supportive because it's like, wow, these are people going through really hard things basically alone, right? And so that really triggers compassion. It's not hard to muster it for people in these situations.
I was going to say, if you don't mind, the stuff about the clinical pastoral education part, though, was that you also went back to both the group and a supervisor to sort of say, how did I do? Did this, did I do something stupid? and also there was a sense of also making sure that if I did do something stupid, that either I would go back and speak to the people or that the supervisor would step in. What sort of checks and balances do you have to make sure that folks who are volunteering to talk to folks aren't being manipulative and aren't like getting people's credit card numbers or whatever, that sort of stuff?
Yeah, so I think this is a really important point. And, you know, we've actually mostly been focused on the legal side of handling suicide prevention. We're going to have essentially a panic button, which will allow people to be transferred, people in extreme distress that listeners fear are suicidal to be transferred to a suicide hotline. Mm-hmm. But you raised actually a really good point that we haven't, I think, discussed in great detail yet. Obviously, there'll be a system for reporting someone. If you think someone is a problem provider, there'll be a system for reporting them and having them removed. But, you know, I think longer term, we'll need to figure out strategies to deal with the potential for sort of more subtle forms of manipulation. And as a really good point, we'll have to sort of figure out what the best way to minimize those risks are. And, you know, yes, with the hope, yes, that's the best that I can say.
Yeah. Yeah, because I mean, there's a part of me that also sort of felt like, oh, it's in some ways it's the gig economy of, like, it's the Uber counselor, you know, the Uber driver counselor. You could actually do both. That could be something, too. Like, they pick you up at your house, they talk to you.
Yeah.
You know, and then bring you to the bar. But you know, it's a difference between like a taxi driver who's like taken tests and had people, and they have their license on, the police have their license on record and stuff, opposed to an Uber driver. And so it really is that like struggling with the I think with everybody, you know, institutionalism and authenticity are so important for folks today, and being able to find and to find the help, and like, you know, as opposed to having to call your health insurance, I would like to see someone. Why? And then, you know, all that sort of stuff. Going like, you know, just pressing the button, calling, is a big difference. Yeah.
I mean, to me, actually, you know, because we've had discussions of like, oh, is this a threat to therapists? And I actually think it's a compliment, in the sense that to me, what I would love is for, if Happy can change the culture and make talking to a stranger more normative and more acceptable, then wow, that would be fantastic. That people who actually need the help and the longer term sort of sustained work that a therapist can do with them would be more likely to try that. Right? So I really sort of see this as sort of hopefully a bridge to therapy for some people, rather than in any way as a substitute. I mean, rather than as a substitute for it.
Do the people answering the phones fall under being mandated reporters?
That's really an interesting question. Mandated reporters of crimes?
Or I've been, you know, abusing my child, or I'm going to commit suicide, or, so, you know, any of those.
The suicide piece, we definitely are going to have a structure in place, but that's a really excellent question, and I'm happy that Jeremy is a lawyer, in addition to having a background in psychology. That's a great question. I don't think that we've talked that through yet, and we will need to. It's a really good point.
And Bob, I think you had a question from one of our viewers.
Yeah, our beloved congregant Ann Burns was asking, our staff, volunteers are paid, required to have liability insurance?
Staff as in the call, I'm assuming, meaning as in the people that are receiving the calls.
Yeah, I think
so. You know, right now Jeremy is talking through a lot with a lot of lawyers, basically around what kind of terms and services, like conditions of service, are we going to build in. You know, we're really taking this from the position that, you know, especially to the extent that we market this as not an alternative to therapy, but as a sort of basic human, like, conversation with another human being, you know, at least I think from our initial perspective, just like if you talk to someone on the plane and they say something that doesn't make you feel good, like that person doesn't need liability insurance for having talked to you. That's, you know, the broad perspective that we're taking is that this is sort of just facilitating conversations from one regular human being to another. Mm-hmm. But that's not to say that we are for sure working on how can we set up the expectations and the way that we market this, as well as how can we set up the legal protections for the people on both ends.
Yeah, I think part of what was intriguing to me about this is that, you know, I've been, and a number of us have spent time with this online congregation where people don't phone, but they come to talk to each other. We have a group called Coffee Hour, which is just where people can talk about whatever they want. And it takes a lot of moderation because people communicate really differently from each other, and what's hypersensitive to one person, another person would never know. Now, that's different because a lot of people can respond to a comment. It's not just one deep listener.
And I do think the online component, I think, makes it a little bit different. I think there's more, I think there's a little bit more risk of that online where it's harder to read people's tone, where it's just, where you're not getting the feedback in someone's voice and sort of being able to adjust to that. So that is, I think, part of where the power of a live human being comes in.
It is, and because I run this kind of congregation, I do counseling on the phone with people who, I mean, I'm not a therapist, but I do pastoral counseling, and it's very different not to have the body language. Mm-hmm. Yes, I have the voice, but I can't see the person, and a huge amount of what I learn from people is in their body language. Mm-hmm. Like, even doing this is so different to me than talking on the phone to someone. You know, I spend my life in these video calls because seeing each other, sometimes someone doesn't say anything, but you see their face shut down. Or so, especially with silence, I think on the phone, a silence is really hard to know, whereas in person, you can know they're thinking, they're crying, they're whatever they are. So it's going to take, I mean, I'm really intrigued by this because I think people, I think our competition, if you'll put it in those words, in the congregations increasingly is things like Meetup and apps and 30-second meditations and, you know, that people, the time that it takes to put into actually building a community of people who actually know you and support you from knowing you. And they're both important. I mean, sometimes there's no one like a stranger to just say the right thing. But, I think I just found this really intriguing. That was why I was like, you should come and we should talk to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, like just looking on the Church of the Larger Fellowships, the site, right, if you, like the Community Covenant, right, a lot of those same basic principles, respect, tolerance, compassion, confidentiality, right, are all basically the parts of the things like they that we sort of see, we'd like to see sort of borne out in this app. So I think what you guys are doing is really, in a lot of ways, sort of providing some of this for people who maybe, you know, have looked for a church community in their local area and haven't found one that's a good fit or, you know, whatever. So, you know, we totally support the existence of sort of longer, more sustained communities. And actually, one of the things that we have planned for the app, probably not the sort of initial launch version, but a little bit down, is that you'll be able to favorite a provider. And if that provider, you'll be able to favorite a provider, you'll be able to get notifications when that provider is online. And then if, basically, once you favorited someone, your calls, if you put in a call, it'll get automatically routed to one of your favorites if they're available. Mm. So I think there's a little bit of room for building up that sense of comfort and trust with a specific person, not in the sense of, like, I make an appointment with them, but in the sense that, like, over time there's a network of people that I trust and I can talk to sort of repeatedly.
You know, go ahead, Joanna.
Are there any plans for integrating something like FaceTime or Skype, or is the anonymity just a crucial part of this?
I think, from our conversations, we feel like the anonymity matters a lot. There's actually a lot of research on just how much judgment comes in once you look at someone in a way that I don't think I would want on either end, right? Like callers judging listeners, or you know, givers judging receivers, and vice versa. So I think for us, the lack of a face is actually kind of, lack of a face sounds strange, but the lack of looking at someone is actually, I think, pretty important.
It's like talking to your brother in the dark.
You know? I think, I mean, any of us who are parents know how many of the critical conversations happen when the kid's in the car, not looking at us, and, you know, younger in the back seat, looking at the back of our head, you know.
Yeah.
So often that's what comes up. You know, I've obviously been paying a lot of attention to ways that people support each other remotely. And when I was looking at for Happy the app, there are a number of apps that look like Happy. I mean, the same kind of name. One of them is basically a therapist on call. I mean, it really is licensed therapist. Mm-hmm. And it's like $500 a month. You can call anytime you want to talk to a therapist. And there's always a therapist who will I mean, it's really expensive, but compared to going to therapy for 15 hours, it's not, you know. And so I was really looking at the kind of smorgasbord of opportunities that people have to talk. On the same time, I met somebody a few years ago developing an app for college students who were suicidal because colleges didn't want to hear about it because of liability. Colleges did not want to know. So they would get these calls, and they wouldn't know where the people were, but the colleges wouldn't want them to call them and say there's a suicidal student at your college because they didn't want to know. And I think, I feel this at CLF too, we're in this weird litigious world where, you know, Margo Adler, the wonderful witch, got sued by somebody who tripped and fell in a spiral dance and spent years of her life dealing with this lawsuit of somebody who tripped, you know, and held her responsible because she had the spiral dance. So I think caring, and I just was talking to somebody yesterday, teen suicide, where they had tried and tried to get services and no one would see this kid for a really long time, and they finally got in, and you know, and what they say is go to the ER, just go to the ER, that's what you need to do. And you know, if you're a parent with a suicidal kid, that's not necessarily what you want to do, because that's basically breaking a huge trust. But there, you know, this poor kid, that, you know, the parents got in finally 1 week before he just said, that's enough, I can't do it, you know. And so I see such pain and such need, and social isolation's part of it, and so are many, many other things, but I guess what I'm just trying to say is the systems are so broken that here we are coming up with apps and duct tape to splice together human caring in it.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I totally agree, and I think, you know, there's so many reasons for why communities are more dispersed, whether weaker than they were. And I think, you know, part of the way that we think about Happy is, if you think about like the spectrum of mental health from like a negative 10 suicidal to a positive 10, like blissed out constantly, right? Like most of the services that are out there are really aimed at like the negative 5 to negative 10 range, which, I mean, and even services for those people are not great. They're not great.
They're
but what's out there is mostly aimed at that group. And we sort of feel like there's the positive 5 to negative 5 range, the big middle, where there's just really room for people to be better supported, to help both prevent them from going down the spectrum and to give them potentially the resources to be better partners, to be better spouses and parents to other people in their lives, that they can have these sort of spillover effects. So I think in some ways we sort of see ourselves as sort of like a first line preventative piece to try to keep people from going into these regions where they're really in dire need and then face the prospect of our terrible mental health system.
One of the things Jeremy mentioned is that the caller, the people who receive the calls, also feel much better after the calls.
Yeah, I mean, it's for sure tiring, but it's really, it's profound, and you just feel like I've actually contributed in some meaningful way, right? So it's like, I can have a bad day with my research, and like nothing's going right, and I'm never going to be published, and then I talk to someone, and I'm like, I actually like made this person's life better today in some meaningful way. So yeah, I think it is a powerful experience for the people on the giving end.
That makes sense.
Yeah, we can testify to that for sure. And which actually is interesting because it does remind me. I'm a lot of my ministry specifically focused on serving veterans, and especially from the Iraq Afghanistan era. And it's the isolation that is part of the reason why 22 vets kill themselves a day in this country. And so I'm thinking about like how would this work. As a peer support model, because again, like you know, like it's sometimes people, you know, folks come back and they need a mission, and so being a good listener, there's always like we call it the warrior's oath, where you swear an oath not to kill yourself without reaching out to somebody else and that sort of thing. So this would be a really interesting tool, or I don't know if you've thought about targeted subsets of populations that you might want to work with, but.
Actually, so military veterans was one of the first groups of people that we talked, that actually I wasn't even involved at this point, that Jeremy talked to someone who works with sort of veteran services. And I think he really sort of reaffirmed what you're suggesting, that there's a real need there in the veterans community. I do think there are sort of specific things about the veterans community that, you know, I think that before people sought help and used the app, they might feel like they wanted to be on the giving side of giving it to others, right? Just to this point of having a mission, and that giving it to someone else would help sort of justify or make it more okay to use it. And, you know, I do think that we see people as being able to go back and forth in the service, that you don't have to be just one. You can be a caller and a provider. You know, you'll have the option to go back and forth, but of course not everyone who needs the service is going to be great at doing the providing.
Yeah, there's the rub, right?
So, but I can imagine in some very, like some future where, you know, this is wildly successful, having sort of like a sub app for military veterans, because I'm also would imagine that the communication style that people are comfortable with might be different as well, right? That there are people who may not be comfortable being validated in the same way that people who haven't gone through the military. I don't know, but
one of the stories military folks tell themselves that's terribly isolating is that no one can understand what I'm going through except somebody else who was like right there with me, which is just not true, but it's not there.
So I for sure think we see military veterans as an audience that could use the service. I think it's going to be a challenge to actually get them to uptake it. But I think it could be a meaningful benefit to that group.
Now, the technology of this thing is basically people, you know, listeners sign in, right, and mm-hmm. make themselves available. And that list is somewhere, you know, in a switch, and calls come in, and they get automatically routed through some algorithm to a listener, right?
Yeah.
None of that is new technology.
No.
New right?
No.
Actually, basically, you're like as Meg said, your 1-900, you know, sex talk things have been using this for.
I hope not, but yes, the broader point is true.
You know, as a technology, and so Meg, what would it cost for CLF to set this up among its own members? I mean, you know, that kind of technical, you know, matching up callers and.
I would say a lot. So we have a full-time developer, like an experienced developer working on this full-time. Uh-huh. We've been working on it full-time for many months now, and we still have months to go. So it's not it is not new technology, but it's not an easy tech. It's not a
off-the-shelf kind of.
It's not an off-the-shelf product.
It's not a platform you can buy, huh?
No. If only we would have done that and launched it months ago. But no, so there's, you know, quite a bit that goes into the sort of construction of the back end, even though, you know, that technology is not, like, you know, brand new. And basically it's going to be using, like, a voice-over internet process to route people.
And you monetize this by charging the caller.
Yep, yeah. And then basically we take, essentially in the way that Uber does or Airbnb does, we take some percentage and essentially the caller pays, we take our percentage, and then the rest goes to the provider.
Okay, all right, okay. All this kind of, this is the boring stuff, right?
Yeah, it's really actually very interesting to me, but I'm like that, So, this is expected to go live in August, you said? Is that what
Yeah, our goal is to have something that people can download August, September, right? So something that you could go to the App Store and download. Uh-huh. And where we're at right now is we're actually still recruiting pilot callers. So if anyone's out there and wants to try this service, it's right now it's free.
To call in is free right now?
Yep, to call in is free. Okay. We don't have the app version. So essentially if you go to our website, which is happytheapp.online, there's basically, you can see it, there'll be a give happy, get happy. So if you want to get happy, you go through it, and then you basically click to schedule a call, and there's a calendar, and you say, here's when I want someone to call me.
Interesting.
So that's basically our setup, our back of the envelope setup at the moment. And then for give happy, for people who are interested in being listeners, we're still basically doing these phone interviews. You can click on that to schedule an interview. And then basically those people will sort of be updating them with our progress. And then when things launch, we'll be letting people know, hey, now is the time where there's a live app you can register to be a provider.
That's great. Are you doing, I just wondered this, are the providers going to do any kind of peer support for each other in a Facebook group or anything like that?
Yeah, so we've gotten, a lot of our initial recruitment has come through these sort of social networks that, like right now, there have been a big group of people in LA and a big group of people in New York. And so we're actually planning some summer events where we get those people together, because I think the people that have wanted to be providers are just really excited about the mission. Like, we've just gotten such a positive response to the mission that I do think that there is room for a community of people who say, hey, we're in this together, we value this. And so, yes, we're planning events, and I think longer term, there will probably be other online communities that facilitate that as well.
Mm. That's cool. So, listeners, if you or someone you know might like to be the Uber happy person, you can check this out. And meanwhile, if you just want to try it out and see what it's like,
we would love it. Part of what we're collecting right now is essentially sort of proof of concept data that we'll be taking when we reach out this summer to investors. And so we love having callers, because that's basically what allows us to show, hey, this is something that's valuable for people.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Emily. This has been really interesting and fun.
I'm really grateful to get to talk to you guys. Yeah. And now I'm going to be a follower of your regular hangout. So it's really interesting to hear.
Yeah, it's fun. Well, next week we have Scotty McLennan, also known as the Doonesbury Chaplain. He's most famous because the chaplain in Doonesbury, if you're old enough to know that comic strip, was based on him. But he is going to be talking about his new book, Christ for Unitarian Universalists. Christ, you guys, not Jesus. So if you have time to look at this before next week, I commend it to you. Otherwise, we'll see you then and we'll learn about it from him. Have a great week.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.